Hello and welcome to the second ever episode of the Superpath podcast. Today I'll be talking to Danielle White. Danielle's a longtime content marketer. She also came from journalism, just like Sean in our first episode, but she's taken a bit of a different career path. She ended up working in healthcare. She's worked in B2C marketing and now B2B marketing at Lucidchart. She provided a ton of great insight on career advice, on making tough decisions, on things she's done outside of her actual day job to build equity in her own career. I'll get out of her way and let Danielle do the talking in a second. Just a quick reminder that Superpath is a career resource hub for content marketers. In addition to this podcast, you can get our newsletter. You can join our Slack community. We're working on some courses and a few other things. Would love if you would check that out. Also, if you're hiring for a content role, we can help you. So we can help you with your job description. We'd like to interview you about that role so that you have the opportunity to provide more context about who your ideal candidates are. And we'll also help you promote your listing and find great candidates. So if you're interested in that, shoot me an email, jimmy@superpath.co. Hope you enjoy this podcast with Danielle White. Hey there, I'm Jimmy from Superpath, and today I'm here with Danielle White, who is the Senior Content Marketing Manager at Lucidchart. Did I get that right, Danielle?
That's correct.
Awesome. Thanks so much for being with us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So for context for listeners, I was doing some research on LinkedIn for folks who have interesting backgrounds in content, came across Danielle that way. So we don't know each other prior to this, and really excited to chat with you and learn more about you and your career.
Yeah, I'm excited.
So we can just jump right in. So according to your LinkedIn, it looks like you started, like many content folks do, in journalism. Is that right?
I did, yes.
Could you talk a little bit about that? I mean, did you see yourself initially as a lifelong journalist, or did you sort of hope to use it as a jumping point to go into the tech world, or, you know, how were you thinking about that at the time?
Yeah, so probably should take a step back even before that. So how I found journalism is I was going to grad school to be a poetry professor.
No way. Interesting.
And was actually working at the college newspaper as a copy editor, then managing editor, then ended up being editor in chief. And just to sort of, there was a scholarship involved. It was like the best job, you know, after school job that I could have while in grad school. So sort of fell in love with it there, but there was an incident that involved our local Metro Daily plagiarizing the campus paper.
No way.
And I had to reach out to them and sort of say, hey, we look up to you guys, this isn't right, and was actually offered a job out of that. So I was just finishing my second year of my MFA and was planning to go get my PhD and had to make the decision at that point to say yes to that opportunity and know that, you know, grad school would always be there if I chose, hey, this journalism thing isn't working out, let me go back and get my PhD, that I could make that decision, but that this opportunity I felt like I needed to take. So I started out as a communities reporter and ended up pretty quickly on the World of News copy desk. And then my managing editor at the time had a vacancy on the sports desk and said, hey, we don't really have a lot of leadership over here. How would you feel about moving to sports? And I said, yes. So I think the main thing is I wasn't planning on being a journalist. I always knew that I loved writing. I obviously was an English major, but fell in love with journalism. Once I was there, I did sort of think I would end up working my way up the ladder, managing editor, executive editor, that sort of thing. But, you know, this was 2007. And right. Very quickly became apparent that the industry was struggling. And I survived 9 rounds of layoffs in my 5-year journalism career.
Oh my gosh. Wow.
And there's just trauma that is involved with that, right? Because you're either super stressed out, when is my turn going to come? But then also the survivor's guilt on the other side of that. And between that and my mom passing away, actually, and just sort of having the reality check of, you know, life is short and I was missing a lot of things in the sports desk. I had split weekends, working nights, weekends, missing all family functions, a lot of things that were important to me to work. And it was sort of just this moment of, if I'm going to make a move, I'm still young enough and adaptable enough that I should probably do it now.
That is so interesting. So at that point, were you eyeing content marketing and saying, this is the field I want to jump over to? Or was it a more gradual discovery?
Again, it was sort of a happenstance and opportunity that I said yes to. So a coworker of mine had a friend who had moved to town who was a former journalist. So she was a journalism escapee who was in content marketing, and they were looking to add another person to their team as a managing editor. And she and I met for coffee, hit it off right away. She sort of walked me through what that transition looks like and why she still really likes her job and how it has so much of what she loved about journalism, the research, the getting to talk to people, the figuring out audience. And actually, I ended up getting that job and made that transition then.
That's fascinating. So is that at Alliance Health? That's your first,
yes.
Your first like
yes.
True content mm-hmm. job?
Yep.
Okay, gotcha. So once you sort of dove into that role, you're there for a few months. I mean, did your sights start shifting a little bit? Did you start seeing like kind of a new, at least potential career path for yourself as you work in this new industry?
Yeah, I think in the first few months, I was definitely experiencing some culture shock. I think that journalism, unlike I would say probably many professions, really becomes your identity. I think a lot of people, like, you can't turn it off.
Yeah.
You see the world through a journalistic lens. Your relationships are mostly with journalists. You approach life with the critical thinking skills of a journalist. You ask a lot of questions that can sometimes be jarring to people. But so I feel like it was a rough adjustment and just disorienting at first. But once I sort of got the lay of the land and realized how things were working, I realized the potential and for things to grow. So immediately we started adding social media and a newsletter and different channels. And I just sort of fell in love with the way that you could speak to different audiences through different channels, but get your same message across. So that was really an exciting revelation for me.
I have heard some former journalists say things like, you know, leaving journalism for content marketing felt like a little bit like selling your soul. You know what I mean? Like you have to now monetize the writing that you do in a very, I mean, I guess journalism is also monetized, but in a very different way. Like, did you have that feeling at all? Or was the opportunity to kind of seek out like a different work-life balance enough to make it an obvious choice?
Yeah, I definitely think I was more afraid of feeling that way leading up to leaving journalism than I ended up feeling in actuality. I think at that time, I was feeling really a lot of pressure to succeed, because I think people who make a career change like that, people kind of wait for you to fall on your face.
Right, yeah.
Or expect you to, or it had that sort of I told you so moment. So I didn't feel like I sold my soul, but I definitely had to sort of dig deep and figure out what my new purpose was. I think it's like I said, when you're a journalist, that's your identity. You have a very clear purpose. It's to inform the masses. You take it very seriously. And it's hard to kind of reckon, well, my new job, I'm making money for my company. So you have to sort of do some deeper searching to find that meaning that just is beyond that.
Yeah.
That I don't feel like you necessarily have to do as a journalist. It's not like a one-to-one connection as obvious.
Right. I've never worked in journalism. My impression of it is that a publisher would keep the journalists, the writers, everybody separate from the ad sales team, so as not to create any conflicts there.
Yeah.
Is that how that works? And was that weird?
Yes.
When all of a sudden all that's mashed together?
Yes, that was definitely weird. I think every publication handles it differently. At the publication I worked for, ads people were in a completely separate building in a different part of town.
Oh, wow. So really separate. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Really separate. And then the editorial staff, so the opinion writers, were on a separate floor, so that we wouldn't inform one another as we were working side by side.
That's so interesting. I mean, what a crazy, totally makes sense, but it's just so crazy how different that is from the content world, where like that stuff is so deliberately put together. Like it can't, those two things cannot exist without each other any longer.
Exactly. So I remember the first time when I was at Alliance and they were like, we need to start writing about MS because we're being sponsored by this drug company or whatever. And I was like, they don't get to tell us what we're writing. We have right. this editorial calendar all filled out for the next month. We can't just like swap that out. And I very quickly learned that that's not actually how it works. So
right. Were there things from your journalism background that were immediately useful when you made that switch?
Yes. The biggest, easiest part for me was managing freelancers.
Oh, interesting.
So there were the two of us in house, but then we had a queue of freelancers that needed to be nurtured, but also we had to grow the freelance team quite a bit. And that was like my bread and butter. I'd already done that for years and managed writers as an editor and things like that. So that relationship with a writer and coaching them through ahead of the story, you know, scoping it out, what are we looking for, outlining expectations, giving them some ideas for resources. And then on that other end, that sort of side-by-side edit of this is where I think we can really blow this out, or this is where I think we need to cut back, or we're missing this piece. That was easily transferable.
That's so interesting. I was going to ask you like what tips do you have for managing freelancers? And you just gave a bunch of really good ones.
Yeah.
You know, like my own experience managing freelancers is if you don't give them tons of context and guidance, they're not working alongside you at the company or day. Like it's just, you could get something fantastic back, or it could be so far off base that you like have no idea how it ended up there.
Yeah. It could be a very frustrating experience if you don't do that work up front and give them the context they need, because then they're out sort of just grasping at straws. And then what they come back with, you're going to be frustrated with, have to rewrite, have to edit, feel, you know, upset that you're paying them, or there's lots of room for conflict there. But if you just take the steps ahead of time, I think it can be a very smooth relationship.
For sure. And also, I mean, from your own career trajectory, having a team of freelancers that you trust and they trust you, that you can bring with you from job to job is also, I would imagine, yes, really useful.
It is.
So from Alliance, you've done now B2C content and B2B content.
Yes.
So you've done a lot of interesting things here. Could you talk a little bit about the differences between the B2C stuff you're doing at Unique and then the B2B stuff you're doing at Lucid?
I think at the end of the day, B2B and B2C aren't as different as we try to make it seem, just as content marketers. I think it all boils down to very similar things of understanding your audience and understanding where they are and finding them in those places. I just think that those channels work a little bit differently and finding those audiences work a little bit differently between the two. So at Unique, I found that email and social media especially were really important. Influencer marketing, that sort of thing, being demonstrable with the product. So showing people what this foundation did or what this mascara did, that was really the bread and butter. With B2B, it's more about finding people's pain points and speaking to those. So, oh, you're having a hard time envisioning your current state versus your future state and what steps you need to take to get there. Oh, let's lay this out for you so that you can see that. It's still demonstrable, but you're not going to throw that up on social media, on Facebook, and have it blow up, you know, a flowchart, the same way that a video about mascara would.
Totally. It's interesting to me that you've done a few different things in your career. And like one thing we see so much in the tech world is that folks bounce around from job to job. And I feel like sometimes like millennials, for example, get a bad rap for job hopping. In my own experience, it's the best way to grow your career faster and like expose yourself to new opportunities. I mean, could you talk a little bit about, and you don't have to name names, but like as you sought out new jobs, was it because you just felt like you'd accomplished what you needed to accomplish at that job and you're ready for something new? Or were you sort of looking to pivot using some of your existing skills and then add some complementary skills that you would pick up at a new job?
Yeah, I think that with the exception of one, every new company I've worked for, I was recruited in some way, shape, or form.
Interesting.
So whether that was an internal employee, so Unique, for example, an employee I had worked at my previous company was then working there and said that this job was just opened up. You are perfect for it. I've already told my boss and his boss that I'm going to try to get you to apply. Please apply. So I applied, not really actually being ready. I was an executive editor. I was over a team of like 60 at that point. It was I didn't dislike my job. I didn't necessarily feel like I had, you know, experienced everything I needed to experience there, or had challenged myself enough there. But I went in and I had the interview, and I had a couple interviews and just asked a lot of questions and kind of just listened to my gut. And I saw some potential for opportunities that I just wouldn't have working at the company I was working at previously, just areas that I had some social media, but this I would really be able to dive into social media, for example. Had some email marketing, but this I'd really be able to have like a massive email list and be able and data to really dig into. So the challenge just became very intriguing. And I feel like that's been sort of the case in each move.
So in all those cases, was it a friend or a former colleague or something who recruited you, or did you get approached by any like professional headhunters during that time too?
Yeah, with Lucid, I got approached by our recruiter.
That's so interesting. It's funny because there's like, you've mentioned a couple things in even in this brief chat that I would highlight as like really fantastic career advice. Like there's so many things that individuals can do to build equity in their own careers. You know, things like building a professional network, being open to new opportunities, building up that network of freelancers you can take with you. You know, like other things that might fall into that list are like maintaining a personal website or taking courses to like develop new skills or whatever. But there's like so many things you've done for yourself that have not only, on one hand, you were open to new opportunities, but two, you were prepared to take them when they showed up.
Yeah, I think that's accurate. I would not consider myself a very natural networker. I'm slightly introverted by nature, but I do think that once I build a relationship, particularly in the company I'm working with, I'm able to be a resource for people. I'm able to, yes, prove myself in the traditional sense, but also I think building those relationships just goes a long way, because if you would have told me the people that have referred me to other jobs would have been the people that would refer me to my next career move, I would have never believed you. They weren't like my best friends. They weren't people that I necessarily felt like I worked super closely with, but for whatever reason, what I was doing made an impression on them. And so I guess just understanding that you never know who's watching, who you're influencing at any given time, and yeah, just nurture those one-on-one relationships.
That's so awesome. And so you live in the Salt Lake area. Have all of these jobs been in-office jobs, or have you dabbled with remote work at all?
This is the first time I've done remote because of COVID.
Oh, interesting.
So yeah, all of them have been in-office jobs, from Ogden, which is about 40 miles north of Salt Lake, to Lehigh, which is about 40 miles south of Salt Lake.
Got it. And is that deliberate? Like, do you prefer working in an office, or is that just how the cookie crumbled?
That's just how the cookies crumbled.
Yeah, yeah. As you look back at your career, and like, you know, hindsight is 20/20, like when you look back, it all seems so obvious. You know, are there things like, if you could offer a little advice to yourself 5 years ago or 10 years ago, is there anything that you would tell your younger self about the things that are coming?
Yeah, I think the main thing I would say to myself is don't be so concerned with traditional paths. I think there's the corporate ladder that tells you after you're a manager, you should be a senior manager, and then a director, and then this and that. And that doesn't necessarily, job title and pay to a certain extent, don't necessarily motivate me. So I think you have to know what motivates you. My curiosity motivates me quite a bit, and potential for impact are the other two things that really I have found through a lot of trial and error are bring me the most satisfaction. If I'm able to kind of follow my curiosity and learn new things, but then also if I'm able to make impact, and that can be everything from impacting people's careers to impacting a huge campaign to rebranding an entire company, right? Like impact can mean different things, but for me, I found all of that is way more meaningful than job title.
Yeah.
But I was very much an overachiever, classic overachiever growing up. And so for me, it was like, no, this is what you do. You go this first, then, you know, you go up the ladder, and that's the definition of success. But for me, success is really what makes you happy in the day to day.
Right. I find that, I don't know if this is unique to content marketing or not, but it seems like in the content world, there is no clarity whatsoever on what a career is supposed to look like, which is good and bad. I mean, I think for some people, it's too much gray area, you know, and they want to know what is the track they're supposed to follow. And then for others, it's this canvas they can paint on and make it whatever they want, which I think is really cool.
Yeah, I agree.
Any advice you would offer to up and coming folks in the content world, whether they're coming from journalism or coming at it from some other background? I definitely find that most folks discover content sort of by accident. Like they're always coming from somewhere else. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I think that having coached a lot of writers, the one thing I would give, advice I would give to young writers is get out of your own head and listen. I think a lot of writers have the tendency to try to impress with their writing. And so they're very much in their head and trying to craft this beautiful thing. But if you are able to listen to the people you interview or researchers or social listening, you know, listen to your audience as well and listen to how they speak and how they view things and what they're concerned about, you will be a much better writer and you will be a much more successful writer. Your content will be more successful if you really develop those listening skills and speak to people how they want to be spoken to, rather than, you know, being the next Hemingway. I feel like that's a very young writer tendency.
Yes, totally. Are there certain skills that you find yourself leaning on over and over again? Like, is it your writing chops or is it your sort of journalist instinct to ask lots of questions or something else?
Yeah, I think, you know, every story is different. So you have to approach storytelling in a different way for everything that you do. And I definitely feel like my writing's evolved over the years and all the various audiences I've had to write for. But I think really what I find myself learning over and over again is how to measure success and then communicate that success. So early in my career, it was page views and hits, and that was like all that mattered on the journalism board. And then later, you know, keyword stuffing and those sorts of things started affecting page views and things like that. And it's like, no, you really need to look at time on page or likes and shares. And then that even became a vanity metric.
Yeah.
Just because of paid and algorithms. And so with technology, anything can be gamed. So I feel like you have to stay a step ahead of it. But I definitely think that valuable content has its place and should get valued. It's just harder to communicate that. It's become a lot harder to communicate that over the past few years.
Right.
Especially to executives who are very focused on ROI. That's been a challenge for pretty much every place that I've worked. At Unique, for example, we found that it took 7 touch points with our brand. So whether that was social, blog, email, our website, whatever, to make a purchase. So the long game is really important, and that's not as easy to track and report on and communicate up. But, you know, like if you post something and it only gets 300 views or something like that, but that might have been somebody's first touch point, and 6 touch points down the road, they may end up purchasing. You don't have that as obvious a connection.
That's so awesome. Is the 7 touch points, I mean, was that, that's kind of like the average when you look at like across all the data and all the customers you have?
Yeah.
That's so fast. Because once you have that, it becomes such a powerful lens to look at all of your data through.
Yep. And interestingly enough, the first touch point and the last touch point, which, you know, frankly, most companies, that's what they look at, either or the first touch point or the last touch point, were both social media, but they viewed the website, they read our emails, they subscribed here, they did that in between.
Right.
So a multi-channel approach, which I feel like most places are on board with now, I definitely feel is the way to go, but also just that patience and understanding that you're building a relationship with someone, and it's kind of one way. You know, you'll see them pop up in your metrics here or there when they view your page or whatever, but you're really building trust and a relationship. And so needing to be patient with that ROI and understanding what you're doing there, you're building a reputation, I think is important for people to understand.
Do you have any thoughts on how to explain that or convince a manager who is having trouble absorbing that fact? You know, like so often we see managers who say they're so used to, for example, paid acquisition, and they just know dollars in, dollars out. Like if you bumped into that where whoever you have to report to doesn't quite get it.
Yeah. So that seven touch points that I just referenced was a great example. I only know that because I had to do the deep dive to kind of prove my larger point. Mm. So using data where you can to tell a story, I think is a skill that not all content marketers have or really want to develop, but it's super necessary. If you view it as just another story you need to tell and dive into those numbers, I think that they'll pay off for you so much. Another example is lifetime value of a customer. So if you can prove that people who come to your web page are only this likely to subscribe or purchase your product versus the people coming to your blog or subscribing to your newsletter, and then follow them throughout their journey with your company and be able to prove lifetime value, whether that's a yearly subscription or, you know, they come back and purchase your products over and over again, then you're able to prove where you should invest in your time and resources.
Got it. That's fantastic. Where can people go online to see some of your work or connect with you?
LinkedIn's probably the best spot. And then I can send you whatever you may need from there.
Cool. Cool, cool. I'll make sure to include a link to your profile in awesome. The show notes for this podcast. Well, thanks so much, Danielle. Really appreciate your time. We'll definitely be sending folks to your LinkedIn profile and hope to chat again soon.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Jimmy.